Hi there, and welcome to the Proud to Be of Rust and Glass podcast. Today's guest is Dr. Tim Geiger. Tim is the author of multiple poetry collections. He's also a professor at the University of Toledo. And you're probably one of the first people that read any of my writing and said, you know what, this kind of sucks, but it doesn't all suck. And that was probably some of the most useful advice, some of the most underrated advice that I could have ever gotten, because you do realize, you know, I might be able to write, but right now I can't. I just got to keep at it. So it's been a long time since I was a student of yours, but we've, you know, fortunately crossed paths at some other events and things like that since then. And now we're here, and I'm so happy to have you on the show today.
Happy to be here.
Thanks for taking the time. And I think we'll just, you know, jump right in. How long have you been a poet?
Oh, 35 years. 35 years.
So you weren't always super into poetry, or was it something that found you a little bit later?
Yeah, it was in high school. Actually, it was in more or less undergrad when I was a college student. I started as a scientist.
Okay.
Thought I was going to be a scientist, and then took some creative writing classes, and I got bit in my junior year of undergraduate studies and switched my major from psychology to creative writing.
Amazing. What kind of sciences were you into before then?
Mostly, I grew up in the forests, so I was very much into, you know, wanting to study forestry, taking biology classes, and then, you know, realizing later on it wasn't my forte. Mm-hmm. So I switched over to psychology and realized that wasn't my forte.
Sometimes things that you're meant to do, your passions, are a little late in finding you. Sometimes you have to go through some trial and error. Do you still have interests in those subjects and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think that's why poetry found me, because I kind of realized that poetry encompasses all my interests, you know, the interests in the science and the interests in nature. And I realized I could just write about those things.
Oh, that's amazing. That's really cool. How has, you know, since your junior year of your graduate studies, when you got bit, as you said, mm-hmm. how has your poetry self changed and evolved over time?
Wow, pretty extensively. When I first took my very first poetry workshop, you know, much like I told you, I wasn't very good. And my teacher at the time, Christopher Buckley, really set me in motion on the path to, you know, being a writer, I guess. Kind of instilled in me the sense of, you know, writing every day and, you know, just focusing on the idea that I was a poet, that I, you know, that's what I was going to do. So it became pretty much a passion that led me to graduate school and then led me to, you know, an eventual career in teaching poetry.
Do you think that relationship you had with that early teacher was a big sort of factor in choosing to be a teacher yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, he's still a very good friend.
Oh, amazing.
You know, so he was kind of moving through the system and settled where I went to undergraduate in Westchester, Pennsylvania, at Westchester University. And he was only in his second year there when I met him. And, you know, we stayed in touch. He got me to engage with graduate studies and, you know, helped me along every step of the way. So,
oh, that's very cool. That's really cool that you guys are still in touch too.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
you know, hopefully still influencing each other's writing and, mm-hmm. and kicking each other in the butt when you need a little bit of push.
Yeah, he's one of my best editors. I
oh,
mean
cool.
He's, you know, he reads everything I write, and I read a lot of his stuff too.
Oh, that's amazing. As far as like the themes and the subject matter of what you find yourself writing, has it always been pretty consistent, or has that sort of changed as the seasons of life have changed?
Yeah, it's changed quite significantly. I think each of the books, I have four books of poetry out, and you know, they've each thematically changed. So the first book is very much engaging with growing up Catholic. Mm-hmm. My second book is, you know, when I met my first wife and fell in love. So there's a lot of love poems in that second book. The third book is more being engaged with nature. And my newest book, my wife and I bought a farm. So that book is all about living on the farm and engaging with that world.
Amazing. I love it. It's hard not to let life influence your creative work. And it is really interesting to have that perspective, you know, years later to look back and say, oh, yeah, that's who I was then,
mm-hmm.
Through reading what you come out with. And it sort of gives you an interesting perspective when you read stuff from other people, too,
yep.
where you can sort of start to see different chapters in their life through the stuff that they're coming out with.
Yeah, no doubt. You know, the each of the books is influenced by, you know, reading in that field at the time. So, you know, reading about Catholicism and, you know, reading other love poems and then letting those influence my own writing.
And when you sort of made a decision to sort of transition from writer to teacher, was that a smooth transition, or was that something that, you know, offered some challenges in its own?
Yeah, when I was in graduate school, you know, part of my stipend for being able to go to graduate school for free was to teach composition classes. And so I really just, you know, absorbed myself in that. I kind of compartmentalized my life in graduate school, where there was my teaching, there was my writing, and then also, you know, my other interest, which is book arts. So I did a lot of letterpress printing. But that whole aspect of teaching kind of allowed me to excel at it, so that I was given the opportunities to teach creative writing courses and to teach more advanced literature classes. And then after graduation, they offered me an assistantship, you know, to stay at Alabama to continue teaching. And that led to being able to put that onto a resume that allowed me to get Amazing. My first job, which was a sabbatical replacement in Minnesota. And then from there, I was able to come to Toledo and be hired. So
a jump from Alabama to Minnesota to Toledo, those are three completely different places, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
Do you ever miss the other places that you used to live in?
No, I'm grateful that I was able to live there, but I really love living here. Yeah. This is closer to what I grew up. You know, I grew up in Pennsylvania, so, you know, the season's changing and things. Minnesota was just too cold. Alabama was just too hot. This is kind of just right here.
Just in between, like the Three Bears.
Yes.
The opportunity to be in a place like Toledo and to create is also sort of a unique opportunity, because I think we do it a little bit different than others. And I think as a professor, as a writer, as somebody who's been in that world for, you said, 35 years or so, you've probably seen that firsthand with a lot of people that you've encountered over the years, right?
Absolutely.
What do you think makes writing in the Midwest different from, you know, pursuing it elsewhere?
I think the whole notion, there's a blue-collar sensibility to a lot of the writers in Toledo, to a lot of what they do. They're very much grounded in, you know, everyday experience. And I think that that's very accessible to a lot of other people. So I think, you know, that allows the arts to flourish here. You know, people can relate to it, to what they're reading about. And I think in a lot of other places, you know, I think about Alabama, for instance, it's very much tied to this Southern Gothic sensibility that I don't think the common person in Alabama necessarily experiences in the same way that the writers do, that at least at the university that I was at. It's kind of its own little world there. So I feel more like in Toledo, there's really no distinction between what I would say academic poetry as opposed to blue-collar poetry. I think that there's a, you know, they bleed into one another really successfully.
Right. And it's something that the readers and the people who are consuming that material can also connect with.
Yeah, absolutely.
They don't feel like they're looking up at it in a high tower. And,
yeah, yep, yep. And not only that, but they feel that they can do it as well. So, I mean, we have a lot of, you know, writers in Toledo who are successful writers. So.
A lot of active, very vocal people willing to go out on a Thursday night, Friday night, and, you know, share their hearts with each other and close spaces and also in open venues. And it's really cool to see.
Absolutely.
So you mentioned the art of bookmaking. I think that was probably one of the most unique courses I ever took in college, where we actually started from making paper with pulp. We did typesetting, we did bookbinding and that kind of thing. How did you find yourself in that?
Well, this is an interesting story. So when I was an undergraduate and I was a psychology major, I had, you know, was basically that semester, that fall semester is my junior year, I took a creative writing course as an elective. And one of the psych classes I thought I needed to take was called typography. And I thought, well, this is a course where you go in and you type people, figure out what type of person. And I walked into this room and there was printing presses and handset lead type. And I was like, this is not a psychology class. But I fell in love with it right away. And so it was kind of a real convergence of that situation of being able to start studying creative writing and then have the hands-on experience of setting, you know, type and setting my own poems, that it was, you know, I knew that that was, I'd found the place I belonged. And then I was able to go to Alabama to study poetry. And they also have the book arts program set up at Alabama, which is a, you know, nationally recognized program. So I was able to get two degrees at the same time. And that's what I kind of meant earlier when I talked about compartmentalizing, that I was able to, you know, kind of do these simultaneous degrees and also teach at the same time. And it just worked out.
That's very cool. And one of my favorite parts of that class was sort of the final project was something that we were able to work with a semi-local writer to actually bind a very unique set of their books. Mm-hmm. You do that every time you teach that class, right?
Yes. Every semester, I try to get a recognized writer, either a lot of local writers, but also a lot of nationally and internationally known writers, and we'll put together their book as a course or as part of the course, where the students get to have hands-on helping to design it and, you know, choosing the typeface, choosing the paper, making the paper, setting the type, printing the book, binding the book. So they go through the whole ground up of how to put together a book from start to finish.
Who are some of the coolest authors that you've been able to partner with?
My most favorite was the first year I got here. We were able to do Philip Levine, who is, you know, the Pulitzer Prize winning, National Book Award winning poet. And he was always one of my biggest heroes in the poetry world. And I contacted him and he was happy to give me a collection of 5 poems. So we printed his chapbook, Smoke. And probably one of my proudest moments as a bookmaker was I was at the Associated Writing Programs conference out in Palm Springs in the year 2000. And he was the keynote speaker. And he got up and he was going to give his reading. And he said, I'm going to read from my favorite book. And he held up my book that I printed.
The one that you guys made.
And I was in the audience of 1,000 people. And I was just like started beaming. And he mentioned my name. And he said, yeah, this was done by a class at the University of Toledo. And it was just a great, great experience.
That's beautiful. Yeah, that's a moment where you think, oh, hey, I'm definitely doing something right here.
Yeah, that was where it all kind of came together. But, you know, we've done a lot of other books, too. You know, Carl Phillips recently did a book by one of my colleagues at UT, Dustin Pearson, Peter Everwine. He was a pretty well-known poet. We were able to do his last chapbook before he passed away. So Naomi Shihab Nye, I can go on and list.
There's a lot of them. Yeah, that's really cool. That's such an amazing project. I love collaborative projects, and that is, I think, one of my first introductions to that being a possibility, that being a thing that you can do is working with other people and sort of elevating it from just a printed book that you get from a mass distributor to actually this real unique work of art that you're producing.
And that's what I try to, you know, engage the students with is the idea that you're making a piece of art here. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a book, but it is a handmade book. Mm-hmm. It's a one-of-a-kind thing. And so when the students get to do their own projects too, because of course they get to print their own writing or they can choose an author and print something by them, you know, it's that notion that they are creating a work of art.
That's very cool. I still have 3 sheets of marbled paper from that class. Ooh. I think that's all I have as far as relics from that, but I'm pretty sure Theo, my 6-year-old, has acquired those at this point.
Well, you have to bring them into the lab. We can make more.
Oh, that'd be so cool. Yeah. He would love that. You just you mentioned the life on the farm and that your latest book is revolved around that. I see that you brought that along. Would you like to share some poetry for us today?
Sure, I could read some of these poems.
Amazing. I'd love to hear it. It's one of my favorite parts of these interviews is actually getting to hear some of the work. And
so this book is called In a Field of Hallowed Be. And as I said, my wife and I bought a farm, and it was life-changing to move to that farm. We were, you know, have always lived in the cities and the suburbs. So when we were presented with this opportunity to move out to the country and start a new life, we really engaged with it, and it changed us. Mm-hmm. And so this book is all about those changes in a way. And this first poem kind of is the start. It's a prefatory poem. It's a longer poem. And it kind of talks about how I got there. So this poem is called After All. I carry my impermanence in layers of bone, muscle, skin, this blue t-shirt and jeans, out here to this permanence that even now may be fading. Here is my land, a house, a barn, 5 acres, some chickens and some goats. The field reaches to the tree line, full of ticks and timothy grass, and listens intently when I tell it that one day I will make it an orchard of apple and cherry. I will keep it mowed, watered, and cared for as it's never been cared for before. It's just earth and clay down to the frost line, and who knows how much farther till the limestone appears, makes a backbone it all balances on. But up here, as we say, in the country, it's just field. It's the place I never thought I'd arrive at after that alley off South Street, 19 and 2 stoned to find my way back to the apartment's address my friend Ron gave me only an hour before. Before what? Before we snorted 6 more lines in the bathroom of Jim's Steaks, and he left with a guy nicknamed Evil to score 2 more 8-balls of crank. He won't be home in the morning, or for another 3 days, and I'll be gone by then, catching the bus back up Market Street, then west to Bryn Mawr. But first, I need to make my way back to his place. I need to have an argument with the traffic light, the homeless guy with no hands, the Hare Krishna in a robe so orange it burns my eyes. I need to stare down the stares of every passerby on that city street, the shame I felt surrounded by families, tourists from Brazil, the cops who stopped and asked from the backs of their horses, "What's wrong with your eyes?" I tell them I was born this way, always looking sideways or down. Eventually, I'll make it to his doorstep, to the bus terminal, to Bryn Mawr, where I'll hitch a ride with my uncle who's been drinking since lunch, since he broke his spine online at the plant. Back to my parents' house and classes the next day, a handful of core requirements at the local 2-year college, still having no idea where I'm going or what I'm supposed to do with my life. I'll find the words to tell my mother, "Yes, I'm shopping. I'm fine. I was just shopping. That's all." Skipping stairs on the way to my room and a blessed sleep I haven't had for days. My heart will finally slow down, and the walls will stop dissolving, and I'll say, "Enough," and find my way here, 35 years from there. Does what happened in between finally make any difference? What little I remember of it, at least, which is less and less the older I become. There were places I found myself I should never have been. The junkie squat, the police lineup, passed out in the back seat of my alcoholic uncle's car. But there were also places where I always felt I was meant to be. And really, most of those were just like here, their own particular shades of green, essential to the overall compositions of forest and meadow and mountain, burning off into the clouds. Alabama, Minnesota, Montana to Ohio, March through April, the maples erupting in emerald jackets, peaking to a different orange, then fallen and raked to a different burning, rising into the night sky and drifting always east, covering all the nameless constellations until the morning rose. And each journey to get here, miles under the same tired sky, revolving over the same earth that never went anywhere after all. And the memories of them, of Ron, dead at 27 from hepatitis, of Evil, who I never met, but who got gunned down the following week, and my uncle, who finally quit drinking, then died within a month, and my mother, gone 10 years, who listened and didn't believe a word I said. They're all gone, but each got me to here, where my bones stretch against the skin of my fingertips, plunging into this clay, as killdeer rise like ghosts from the milkweed of the west pasture, where I am now asking this field to show me how to live.
There's a lot that has changed in life, and a lot has changed over the poem. But one thing that I think is, you know, among all the amazing imagery in that story that you just told, the one thing that hasn't changed is you are, in fact, wearing blue jeans and a blue shirt still.
always wear a blue jean and blue shirt.
I love it. That was great. You got another one for us?
Sure. I got another little short one. This is about my dog. So I have a Great Pyrenees, 165 pounds of pure dog. And this is when we first got him as a puppy, and it's a sad poem, but he's just being a dog. I wrote this after the poet Dean Young passed away, and I was sitting on my back porch, and I got the word, you know, through the internet that he had died, and he was one of my favorite poets, and he died very young. And this poem is called Overcast, and this is dedicated to him. There are so many dead baby rabbits in the yard, I've given up hope. the power lines buzzing like a broken doorbell above the cornfield next door. The dog found the nest hidden in the garden and dragged them out, one by one. Four pine trees shuffled their backs, turning. He didn't kill them right away, but his roughhousing was their sundering. I'm trying hard not to redefine play as murder. He carried each almost gently, like you might carry someone else's used handkerchief. A plastic grocery sack weigh of alms from the field fence. He left one beneath the crabapple, another abandoned by the garden shed, one in the middle of the path leading back to the chicken coop. 2 days later, I'm still finding their swollen gray fur bodies blossoming flies above the uncut lawn. The toes on a baby bunny's foot are delicate whispers. There are graves, and then there are more graves. He didn't know they would die so easy, so maybe he too has lost hope. It's hard not to feel like the whole world is ending. It's easier to forgive him, easier still to feel sorry. The weather in the yard cajoling the clouds to come down to earth. He's a silly dog.
We had a yellow lab who managed to always find the baby wildlife animals too. So that is unfortunately very, very familiar to me.
Yeah.
And one of the first times I mowed the yard at our new house, I found a baby rabbit hole in a way I wish I hadn't.
Yeah.
So that's an image that sticks with you.
Yeah. It's every, this is the time of the year. And so now we've learned to, you know, basically put chicken wire around all the gardens to keep the rabbits out so they stay out in the back pasture where he doesn't have access to them to grab them.
It's for their own good.
Yeah,
they might not realize it, but it's for their own good.
We're saving their lives.
I do think we have time for one more if you have one in you.
Sure, I have one little one. This is for my mom. This is called Binomial, and there's a little epigram here from Merriam-Webster's, which defines the word binomial. A binomial is a mathematical expression consisting of two terms connected by a plus sign or a minus sign. Binomial. Two horses grazed apart, one on each side of the corral, split in half by a stockade fence, stretching up and disappearing over the grassy hill. The chestnut watched the dappled gray, more gaze than graze in her stance. This may have gone on forever. Not the fence receding, but the longing the horses felt to be near one another. The same ache I still feel when I miss my mother's voice. It's easy to forget. It's not my job to put the world back together. 6 hours and an axe, I could probably take that fence down, split and cast the cedar rails, just fence post stumps sticking up from the ground. 2 weeks before she died, I asked her why she wanted her ashes in an urn behind a granite slab. She told me she'd always lived too far away to be scattered in some ocean, so it all became about remaining whole. There is no ocean. There's no lake or even a river for miles around here, just a pasture beyond the corral, beyond the fence line stretching to the sunrise. Mirages in the blurred distance of perspective into which the separate horses now run.
I know you, in essence, talk for a living with your students, but have you ever done any narration work?
No.
You should.
Really?
Yeah, your reading is just so chill and relaxing that I think it would work.
I do a lot of reading, so I'm in support of this book. I've given a lot of reading, so I kind of have these poems memorized.
Cool. I love it. Well, thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you.
Is there anything related to poetry or life or just anything in general that you wish you would have learned earlier in life?
Boy, I think not so much that I wish I would have learned earlier, but that I wish I wouldn't have forgotten. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, just the use of metaphor. I think that as human beings, this is how we learn about the world. It's through metaphors, but by making comparisons to things. But I think as we get older, we forget that. We forget that that's how we, you know, create our worlds and create our imaginations. So I think that whole period where I went through science, you know, wanting to be a scientist, I got too grounded down in the physical relationships mm-hmm. of the world and stopped looking at the magic mm-hmm. in the world. Mm-hmm. And I think when I started writing poetry, you know, when I started becoming a creative writer, I just rediscovered that. Mm-hmm. So
I was also going to ask if you had any advice for writers, but I think that is probably the best piece that they can get. So
that is my biggest piece of advice is don't forget metaphors. Don't forget to make those comparisons in the world.
If anybody wanted to check out your poetry or check out some of the things that you are working on, is there anywhere they could find you?
Sure. I have a website. It's just timothygeiger@weebly.com. Yeah, and at the university, you know, I'm always encouraging people to come and take my classes. You know, I teach.
They're a lot of fun. I'm not really a poet, but I enjoyed the poetry workshop. I enjoyed it. I think it taught me a lot about myself as a writer, even though I don't really write poetry now. But I think, you know, it's really cool to see that side of things and get that mindset as far as being concise with your writing and telling those stories in fewer words and really learning how to paint those pictures, I think, was really helpful for me.
Yeah, and working on the books, too, you know, doing the book art stuff. You know, that engagement with language on that level is something that I think it's truly beneficial to any writer.
Oh, yeah. Makes it more real instead of getting, like I said, a box of 40 or 50 books from Amazon or whatever distributor you get them from. And it's, you know, that's just like, oh, they're books. But if you actually make it, it's like, oh, it's a book.
There's no doubt.
So amazing. Well, thank you again so much for taking the time to have this conversation with me. I always enjoy talking with you.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It's been wonderful.
I absolutely look forward to seeing what you do next.
Great. Thanks, Curtis. Mm-hmm.
This has been today's episode of Proud to Be of Rust and Glass. From writing to teaching to the art of bookmaking, Dr. Tim has built himself the perfect poet's life. Now, he is a farmer, and his writing is ever evolving with this new chapter. Again, I am your host and producer, Curtis Dieter. Our executive producer is Chris Pfeiffer. If you want to join the conversation, check us out at wgte.org/rustandglass. Until next time, thanks for listening. Now, go forth and create.
WGTE. Voices around us.
WGTE is supported in part by the American Rescue Plan Act funds, allocated by the City of Toledo and the Lucas County Commissioners, and administered by the Arts Commission.